Are you new to investing? Wondering whether or not you can self-manage your properties? Let us tell you about our partner, Rent Ready. Rent Ready is an awesome property management software that can help you grow and handle every aspect of your real estate investing business. Rent collection, tenant screening, maintenance, lease signing, listing. Honestly, Rent Ready has everything.
One of the best features is their new tenant software, Latchel, where you're able to remove yourself as the landlord from being the middleman between tenants and maintenance calls. And it's also essentially a fraction of the cost of what you would pay for property management.
Let me also mention that Rent Ready is unlimited. All their plans are flat price. This means you can keep adding properties to your portfolio without having to pay more. You can close on all the properties you want and Rent Ready's price stays the same. Best part about it is for you guys is they've given us an amazing deal to pass on to all Weekly Juice listeners. You can get 50% off any Rent Ready plan at rentready.com when you use our code JuicePod. That's rentready.com, RENTREDI.com with code JuicePod, JUICEPOD, and you'll get 50% off any plan. If this is your first time here, welcome. During our shows, we interview successful entrepreneurs and investors to spread knowledge, advice, and actionable tactics to help others in the pursuit of financial freedom. We discuss successes, failures, systems, motivations, experiences, and key lessons learned along the way in the hopes that these stories help you along your journey. Tune in every Wednesday to get your weekly juice. If you've been here before and like what you've been hearing, please subscribe, share with friends, rate and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. That goes an extremely long way for us. It's simple. Just click on your podcast app, type in our podcast name, The Weekly Juice, click on the reviews and let us know what you think. The more ratings we get, the more eyes we'll get on our show. And in turn, we'll be able to provide you all with high quality guests. You can also find us on Instagram at Weekly Juice Pod for daily content and personal finance tips to assist in your journey towards financial freedom. Welcome back to the Weekly Juice. Ryan and Corey here with another episode for you. As always, we talk real estate, personal finance, entrepreneurship, and all the above. Today we had on special guest Mark McMahon. He's a real estate investor, flipper, landlord, coach. He has his own course now, all surrounding real estate and investing. He's has 40 years of experience as a contractor or like in the construction field of the game, I guess you will. We talked a lot about estimating rehab costs, buying in high priced markets. He's in Southern California. And I don't know. It was just an interesting story. He talked about how he started out selling koi ponds.
Yeah. Well, he literally was dead broke, like came from, like he had no idea what to do, thought he was going to lose his house and his whole family. Like if you want some inspiration on like just not to give up, he literally said it, just keep swinging away, keep swinging away. And that's exactly what he did. Flipped over 500 units or homes and has 40 units. And
he got the one of the best parts about it, and this will make you want to really listen. He spent pretty much his last $100 to buy a mobile home, found someone to put $5,000 into it for him and made a $14,000 profit to get himself out of the gutter and start paying back what he had owed.
He essentially just taught himself how this business works. And he just says, you just have to keep swinging the axe, keep swinging away. And eventually you're going to look up on top and be like, wow, I came all this way. Ups, downs, valleys, cliffs, all that. And it's a really good perspective from Mark.
Yep. He takes you slowly through each of the processes and, you know, he won't rush through any topic. So fun episode today. Let's dive in and bring in Mark.
Let's do it.
All right, Mark, officially welcome to the Weekly Juice podcast. We are thrilled to have you here. You've come highly, highly recommended. And Corey and I are thrilled to get to know you a bit and have you drop some knowledge on our listeners.
Very cool. Looking forward to it, guys. It's I've been since this morning, I've been working around this because I was looking forward to it. So yeah, this is cool.
We appreciate awesome. You. Thanks so much. So if you could, for those who don't know you, give mm-hmm. a little background on yourself, who you are, where you're from, and then your, I guess, introduction into real estate investing.
Okay. Yeah. My name is Mark McMahon, and I've been investing now for about a little over 12 years. My wife and I started, and we are in a county called Orange County in Southern California. So for reference, that is like halfway between San Diego and Los Angeles near the coast.
Cool.
So we've been here most of my life. And my wife is from Japan. She's been here a long time now, 20 some years. So 25 years, I think. And we were both contractors before we got involved in here. She was a landscape contractor. Believe it or not, when we met, I was actually a koi pond. Yeah, koi, like fish. Koi pond contractor. And I taught people how to invest. Not how to invest. I taught people how to install koi ponds and make money doing it. So that was kind of my thing. So I did that. And then we also installed them as a business too. And that's how we met. She came into the store and bought some pond equipment and fell head over heels in love with me and couldn't.
Who just, wouldn't?
Yeah.
Head over heels.
So Ryan, I knew we'd get along, man. yeah, that's another funny story. Another interview. And then the recession hit. You know, we got married and we had a pretty successful construction business. I've been in construction all my life, building anywhere from houses to tilt up, you know, commercial buildings, apartments, things like that. And then the recession hit and pretty much all of her landscape dried up, all of my koi pond stuff dried up. And I found myself living on the edge, never having invested before, never having, put a lot of money away. I think, you know, we had some money put away and, that went pretty quick. And, we got pretty desperate. You know, we ended up losing everything except for the house because of the amount of time it takes for foreclosure at the time. And I ended up not being able to find work for a long, long time. And then we ended up, I did handyman stuff, but then I ended up getting work with banks doing repos and clean outs and things like that. Property preservation is what they call it. And I started to kind of look more so my wife did. She started seeing that, you know, a lot of these real estate agents were selling houses to other investors. And we got curious. But I was still not making a lot of money at the time. We were still living on the edge. The banks were really slow to pay. It was just a rotten time. It was one of those things where, you know, even though we were working, we weren't making enough to pay the bills and we were still losing things. And, you know, we're just digging the hole. And she finally had enough and said, look, I'm going to go visit my mom in Japan. She sent me some tickets. So she took our youngest son and went to Japan. And I kind of, when the house was empty, I kind of went, damn, if I don't do something pretty quick here, I'm going to lose everything. She may not come back. And I started calling up everybody I know. And it's funny, during that time, I was kind of poking at everything and I had gotten my real estate license. And I called, I think one of my title officers, and I'd sold two houses in like 2 or 3 years. It was insane, not a ton of work and not much money. And she said, go to this investment club. You should go there and see what they've got to say. Cause she was a member. And it was the investment club for women. And I thought, could be fun. It ended up being half men. So it was like, oh. And I sat down next to a guy, not the speaker was this really great guy, that was real famous in the investment community for forecasting. And he talked and I was just mesmerized by, you know, his story and what he had gone through and everything. I was like, oh my God, I that's me, you know, in the previous recession. And the guy next to me started talking to me and he was flipping mobile homes. So long story short, I mean, I could go on and on. This is a whole show right here, but I ended up finding a mobile home, flipped it, made some money, lost money on the next two, broke even on the first house, and ended up making money on the second house. And that was kind of what put us in motion as far as flipping. And then the buy and hold started a couple of years later. Accidentally, we got stuck with the house and it ended up growing into a 12 unit apartment complex, you know, through 1031 later on down the road. We still own that one.
Awesome.
So, okay. That was as fast as I can do that story.
No, that was good. That was good. So fast forward, right? Like you guys up to now, what's the portfolio look like as of right now? How many units do you have and what type of properties are they mixed in as?
So it's 43 doors, a mixture of 6 to 12 unit apartment complexes. I'm down to two single family homes now. Everything was single family homes to begin with. And we 1031 into apartments, and we have a duplex, and then we have four condos in Hawaii that are vacation rentals that, you know, hopefully, you know, no one could go over during COVID in Hawaii. So we were empty, basically empty for a year over there. So that kind of whacked us pretty good, but you know, we've always been resilient and you know, it's kind of getting back on track right now. So, right. You know, our cash flow, with all of that, keep in mind our real estate is super expensive out here. So, you know, the cash flow isn't like it is in, you know, upstate New York or Ohio or whatever.
Indiana. Yeah.
Buy a house for $100,000 and rent it out for $1,500. That doesn't exist here. You buy a house here, if you're lucky in, you know, in the Inland Empire, you can buy a house for $250 maybe and rent it out for, you know, $1,750. But that's maybe $2,000.
So on that point, people are probably curious, like, how do you get up a mass 40 units in such a high price market? Like, are you using creative financing? Are you using other people's money?
Yes. Good question. So during all of this, my wife decided to start blogging to Japanese people about real estate, and they were interested in learning about it. She ended up promoting herself in Japan and became pretty in our small circle of, you know, people, became fairly famous with US real estate investing. So she published a couple of books. We did a lot of live events over there. We'd fly over and do live events, and there was two types of people: people that wanted to buy their own places and people that wanted to invest with us. And that's kind of where we learned about private money really, really early on. And she attacked that with vigor. And, you know, I always tell people, if you want to get into this business, you need to spend your time doing a few certain things. And one of them is spending, you know, 20% of your time, 25% of your time cultivating private money and having that source. So we've been able to raise, you know, a substantial amount of money. I'm not at liberty to say, but enough to where we can fund what we do, our flips and our purchases, you know, until, you know, we can refi. And that has been instrumental. And I can't say it enough. If anybody out there has ever watched what I say, you'll know that I talk about private money quite a bit. And I know everybody does, but unfortunately, most people don't know crap about it. They know what they see, but they're not doing what we've done. Not that there's people out there that have raised way more than us, but we started doing it so long ago. And
yeah, let's talk about you started, and like maybe some specifics on maybe a deal or something that some of your first couple that you sourced with private money, and kind of how that worked out, being that it was so long ago and that that was your entree into it. Like, I think that's hard for people to get started into that. So if you could talk about
that. Yeah. And I've got, you know, if people want to go look in my archive on Instagram, there's a ton of stuff. Unfortunately, I wish Instagram had a way to be searchable, but it's not, because I've got like 1200 videos or some crazy amount of videos on there about how to do stuff. But YouTube is definitely searchable, and I've got stuff on it there. But yeah, the first deal we did was that mobile home. Okay. So we had filed for bankruptcy at that time. And, so of course we had no credit cards anymore. We ended up getting one in the mail. It was weird. We ended up getting one in the mail for like $2,500. For some reason, it got through somebody. And I used that. Plus I used private money for the first time on that. I actually borrowed money from my mom. I borrowed $2,500 from her. So I purchased the mobile home for $100 and I put $5,000 into it, did all the work myself. And we ended up, you know, the numbers elude me, but I think we made somewhere around 14 grand on that deal, a profit.
Wow.
It's all said and done.
You literally just bought a mobile home, like $100 cash.
I mean, it took a ton. There's another story behind that. But going out and getting that mobile home was, because that was what I, you know, I talked to the mobile home guy sitting next to me at the investment club, went out and started talking to managers of mobile home parks the next day, and nobody really wanted to sell me anything. So I finally kind of started stretching the truth and saying that I had a ton of experience doing it. And I ended up getting one from somebody for $100. It was one that was bad. They were going to haul it off. And I said, I can fix it. So they sold it for me for $100. I negotiated free space rent for 3 months, I think, and got it fixed and sold within that 3 months. Wow. So that was back when I was still gung-ho to do the physical part of it.
Yeah. You were trying to rebuild your lifestyle there. Right. So you had the 14K. That's like a little, I don't know if you want to call it a nest egg, but a little baby cushion, right? To start.
Honestly, we were so far behind at that point. It was really exciting until, you know, I think we got punch drunk, you know, that it was like not punch drunk, but we got super excited about that for about 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, yeah, well, this isn't really going to solve our problem. It helps, but it's not really.
What's next?
You know, time to keep moving forward. You know, I like, one of the things I like to share is, you know, short celebrations, just very short celebrations and move on. So yeah, that was exciting. It was good, but you know, the next two were not good. And then the mobile homes, just because I made a mistake and went into a bad park, you know, the manager didn't approve us.
So let's talk about, like, as you started to build this momentum, right? You sound like that you went through some really rough times, like truly rough, and you were down, but that didn't stop you. Right. And you had some sort of breakthrough at some point here. Maybe it was first a mental, maybe not, maybe it was something that actually happened. You can talk about that breakthrough and what started to happen and how you started to learn about building your investment portfolio or the flips, whatever came first for you.
So during that time I was doing the mobile home, I had signed my wife up for a boot camp that was basically, I didn't even know what wholesaling was at the time, but it was a wholesaling boot camp through the investment club. And it was really just a way for people to learn how to find deals. And then the people that ran the investment club would flip them. And that was pretty much it. And Yuko and I did really well on that. We got two or three places under contract in the first month and a half. And we were just putting in offers. Keep in mind, guys, we were so damn desperate. If you've ever had like the bottom of the pit financially with a wife and kids and a house and all the other things that go along with it, you'll understand it's being broke is tough, but being broke and having a bunch of people looking at you every day and you're not producing is terrible. And we were both looking at each other at the time because we were both working when it happened. So we just put massive amounts of time in. We'd repo houses during the day. And we worked till 3 o'clock in the morning, putting in offers literally every day. And that's what did it. There was no goddamn magic at all. There was nothing that was magic about it. It was just brutally hard work. So, and that's exactly what, you know, I'm not doing that now, but I've got guys on the other side of that door over there doing that now. They just put in the reps every single day, offer after offer, quality offers every day.
So how did you learn, Mark, that what made a good offer too? Because you talked about when you're broke, you potentially have this mindset that you don't know how to get out of this hole. Like it's hard to get out of this hole. So how did you know what to look for? What was a good deal? I understand that the course probably taught you this, but like, if you could talk about what you were able to learn in that process.
Not really, because I'm probably, in my opinion, one of the more qualified people to teach people how to do what we do. But the course only goes so far. If you're not willing to put in the time and the effort, there's no course out there that has magic pills. And so the breakthrough, honestly, the breakthrough, it's not very sexy, but the breakthrough was, oh my God, if I work my ass off, we might see some success. And then we saw it. Then we saw it. And then some bad things happened, then some good things happened, then some bad things. You know, pre-show, we were talking about, this is a tough game, right? it breaks your heart and then makes you happy the next, you know, it's up and down, up and down, but it's up and down like this, because it does keep climbing. You might have some valleys that are pretty deep every once in a while, but it does keep climbing if you keep swinging. It's when you stop swinging that it just, then it'll go all downhill. So the breakthrough was just that, oh my God, if I just keep doing the same thing over and over, whether I'm succeeding or not, will be great.
So I love that. By the
yeah,
way.
That's
perfect way to put it. And yeah. that'll get me going. Cause I'll keep going. We are grinding right now. We're going to, it's
yeah. Don't
feels good. I mean,
I love the idea that someone's going to come along with a better potion or a better pill to solve the, I don't want to work so much to get real estate deal problem, but it doesn't exist. There's not a phone system. There's not a list. It just doesn't exist. Doesn't exist, but I can show you how to, do it, but you got to be willing.
Yeah. And you got to build out your own systems for you. We've learned that, like, a lot of people have certain systems. They like this, like that, like it'll go. If you think about just like random apps that you use, you just might have a preference because that's the way you like to interpret data and things like that. Mm-hmm. And everyone's going to be different. So that's why mm-hmm. we try to interview people like you who've been through the ringer and have seen success, because you can then give a little bit more information back to listeners that mm-hmm. they might not have heard from someone else, and they can implement that in their life. But I know we talked a little bit pre-show of like the right way to do things and the wrong way to do things. There's mm-hmm. no perfect storm, perfect potion, as you put it. Mm-hmm. But can you talk about wrong ways to do it, and maybe like over encumbering yourself? And
sure.
That would be amazing.
Sure. Mm-hmm. For sure. So when I teach people to do what we do, it generally doesn't involve as much money as a lot of people think it should or would. So we spend a lot of money on advertising and everything because we've worked our way up to that, right? On marketing. But most people don't have that, you know, $10,000 or $15,000, $20,000 a month to spend on marketing, right? They've got zero. Usually
we don't.
It's funny. Yeah, you understand. But most people get into real estate investing broke. They see something on Instagram, they see something on YouTube, and it's like, hey, look, I got started with no money. And it's, yeah, you can, but you're not going to have a ton of success with no money, but you can't have success. Right. So my whole premise is to start off with what you can do and get good at it. So get good at comping properties, get good at making what I call quality offers. If you can't make a quality offer, if you're just making blanket offers all day long and making so many that you can't follow up on them, you're wasting your time. You got to make quality offers. And we start off everybody on the MLS, you know, well, we've got half of our camp is MLS. Half of our camp is we generate the leads. But you've got to make quality offers. You can't just put an offer on everything, because you've got to have some sort of a verbal relationship with the agent, because there's so much competition right now. There's no reason they should go with you rather than somebody else, other than a relationship, right? Or you, because you're not offering the most money. You know that, right? So yep. We still get deals, even though we're under other people. We still get deals because of the relationships we build on every quality offer we put in. That makes sense?
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's interesting that you said that. And I don't know how well this plays into it, but it just popped in my head. So we're under contract for another duplex. And within this deal, essentially, we talked about it in another episode, so I don't want to beat a dead horse here. But essentially what happens is we owned a property down the street, and we knew the market was scalding hot right now. And we're like, we need this deal. We know how much a cash flow is for. It's perfect for our portfolio. It's not too pricey. And so we went to our agent and we gave him I personally would love to be the guy that can have the conversation, but we already had been using an agent for multiple things. And so mm-hmm. we had to essentially tell him how to pitch us and give him like five different things to say to the selling agent in order to get the deal done. And, you know, a couple of things included, we own the property down the street. The comp that you're looking at is what we bought in September. Here's mm-hmm. the price. We have the dough. We can pay for it. You know, we had to get a really quick, pre-qualification letter, mm-hmm. sent it out, but like, tell your story, right? And like send an email, send a follow-up letter. And it's very hard to do with the market right now because things are moving so quickly. 4 days, that thing's gone, or it's under contract for something else. And then you have to play with the contingencies, and like, you can't really offer a certain amount. Like, we will pretty much never go into a deal without the inspection contingency, because unless they have perfect pictures, there's always something that could sneak up on you and break the deal. So I just bring that up because you talked about like quality offers, right? Like, what are the different levers you can pull within an offer to make a deal work for you, and like maybe change an okay deal into a great deal?
Well, the levers, that's a good question. Well, it really starts with the relationship with the agent. Because so here's what's going to happen. You're going to make an offer on something. Let's just say it's on MLS. Let's just go with that, because that's the easiest way to start is by, most people don't have MLS, but Redfin. The easiest way to get your first deal, other than sitting on the phone for hours and hours, is to start to make offers on listed properties, right? Easiest way to learn to comp, everything like that. Calling up the agent, making sure that they meet you at the house to look at it with them so that you guys can shake hands and you know, go belly to belly and show them that you're serious and that you know what you're doing. So you get to know the neighborhood a little bit. You let them know that you've closed deals before, or that, you know, you work with someone that closes a lot of deals. You know, go off of somebody else's horsepower. You know, if you're going on this alone, and let's say they've got four offers and one of them's from you and you've never bought anything and you've got no track record, they're not going to go with you. They just aren't. I don't care how much you wow them. I mean, if they're seasoned veterans, they're going to go with the person that's going to close it. You know, people aren't looking at the most money all the time. They're looking at the person that's going to close. So when we sell a house, we look at a lot of different criteria. So we're lucky we sell a lot of houses because we flip. So when we look at offers, we get 15 offers in. We look at obviously the amount that they're offering, but that's not as important as the terms. How quickly will they close? How quickly will they release contingencies? You know, how much money do they have down? How much money do they have in the bank? You know, do they have reserves to cover the amount of money that goes if their offer is above the appraisal? You know, those are the things that are important to us. We want to make sure that we have a closer. We're not going after the highest offer. And I truly believe that most people, if they've got a smart agent, don't do that either. I mean, there's a lot of people that's like, I just want the most money and that's it. It's like, yeah, those don't close as well as the other ones do. The ones with the good, strong.
So Mark, what you're saying is if you are a rookie or you're just getting involved, what you need to do is parlay yourself with a really experienced agent or somebody who knows the market and somebody who can help you maybe get over that finish line, because you have to start somewhere, right?
That would help. That would help. But I generally don't work with agents. I just work with a listing agent, because I'll go straight to I'm an agent, but I don't use that very often unless I list a house.
Got it.
Going to the agent and saying, you know, hey, look, I want to write an offer on this house. And then you talk about, you know, meeting them out there and, you know, give them a range price. You know, we always give a range price. Hey, look, you know, I think our price is going to be between $2,000 and $2,500. Does that work for you? Are we within the realm that you wanted to be in? And it's like, yeah, you know, $2,500 is obviously at the top and it's not ever going to go there, but that gives them what they need to know that they're going to be getting the possibility of that. And then we always give them the option to write the offer for us, because obviously, you know, if we find it, and this is the other, I'm not pushing courses, but this is the other course we're almost done with now too. We've got two of them, one for wholesaling, one for buying off the MLS. The MLS one, there's a few things that I'll share today that are in there. So some tidbits is these guys will double end it. And typically that has to do with greed, and the greedy agents will go for double end, right? And they'll push your agenda. If they don't want to double end it, we still get those. We still get a lot of those too, but we know that they're not greedy agents. They're agents that are looking out for their buyer or their seller. So you can find that information out right away up front. If they say, oh yeah, we want to write the offer, you know, and then there's a few other rules that go along with that. But I mean, that's, again, every time I make a right or a left-hand turn here, that's another hour long conversation.
No, you're good. You're good. I wanted to, you just remind me of something, and the way you're saying it, it keeps dinging in my head. It's a relationship game. And that, I'm finding that with a lot of things in the world these days, but like, it really comes down to if people like you or take an attraction to you and like trust you in a way. So the way you bring this up is like sending the agent a letter, an email, meeting face to face, like cultivating that relationship. Like I think about when I'm a hiring manager. So when people look to come in and get hired to our company, it's like, who's the person that sent me a private email went on LinkedIn, sent me a LinkedIn message, as opposed to just sent their resume, just got forwarded in like the black hole of all resumes. It's like,
right.
It's knocking on all those little doors and seeing how much effort they're willing to put in. And then you're like, all right, if they're putting that much effort in here, like that's someone that's going to close the deal, right? They're like, they're putting the effort to just to get the foot in the door. That I can see this going the right way. And it makes you just feel a little bit more confident, right?
Well, absolutely. And then the follow-up is, you know, once you've gone through all that and you've written the offer or they've written the offer, then you go into the follow-up phase. And that's where most people drop off. They think, all right, I'm a shoe-in. I've got this. This guy's going with me. We're done. I can move on to the next deal because I know I'm going to get this one accepted. If you're not following up every day and asking the right questions, you know, they want to know. That's another reason. You hit the nail on the head. That's another reason they're going to go with you, is because of your tenacity. They're going to go, oh my God, this guy's this. I mean, he's to the point of being annoying, but if he's this good on the offer side, he's going to be even better on the closing side.
So I just said to him, I mentioned our real estate agent's name. I'm like, we kind of think sometimes we're badgering him because we pepper this dude with questions and like drive the point home, but he knows we're going to close the deal without fail. We're going to find the cash. We're going to close in 30 days. We're just going to do it because we're so savage and like going at it all the time. He's like, if he has two people texting him, right, he's probably going to go with Ryan and Corey and be like, all right, let me just follow up on this deal. It might not be the most lucrative, but I know it's going to get done 100%. So that probably goes to your point too.
Yeah. The squeaky wheel thing. And it's, you know, and when you're making offers, so we're only talking about MLS right now, but there's three types of offers out there. There's relationship offers. That's where people bring you deals. There's MLS offers. And then there's, you know, marketing offers, the stuff where you're either getting inbound leads, or you're doing an outbound, you know, cold calling. I don't like texting. There's a few things I don't like, but we do a lot of cold calling. When our people start, they have to get their first deal from cold calling, because that usually gives them 2 or 3 months to learn how to be fearless on the phone. And then we make them door knock and do a lot of other things. In fact, my 17-year-old son, we rented the office next door to us, and we've got a bunch of guys over there calling right now. My 17-year-old son's on summer break right now, cold calling. So,
there you go. I saw you guys.
Just a plug for my boy.
Not to cut you off, but I saw you're using Deal Machine, and you guys were driving around driving for dollars, and he was knocking and doing everything. So I think it's cool that you're showing him so young. That is like the key to financial independence, right? You're teaching him financial literacy and how to invest in cash flowing assets as opposed to liabilities. And like, he's 17.
He's set. And my older boys, you know, we were investing when they were younger, but we were just trying to make a living. I mean, believe me, you know, we didn't start investing and going, oh, you know, 2 years later, we're on top of the world. Man, that's been a struggle. You know, it was a struggle for the first 6-7 years to get where we're at, because we were full-time from day one. We didn't have a job to fall back on. But yeah, and I wish, I almost feel like I did them a disservice, but it's been drilled into their heads what they need to do. And they'll be fine too. But yeah, it's the earlier the better, but it's never too late. Never too late. I started at 46.
That's a great message to bring home too. I mean, we're 30, 29, 30, you're 46. There's people that start at 22. There's people that start at 55, 60, whatever. You can be, there's no wrong time to start. Just the best time was yesterday. The better time is today. But one thing I wanted to dive into, or kind of like turn the next page, is into contracting, right? You have 40 plus years in that kind of realm. So to bring the relevancy here, Corey and I are working on a rehab right now. We're on the last leg of it. We've already got about 2 weeks left, and we got to get it renters in and call it a day. But we went through a lot of different, I guess, steps in this process, right? From like getting under contract to then like estimating rehab costs in the beginning. And having not done this, like, this is very daunting for someone, right? We just, luckily we had each other to bounce things off. And like, dude, we're going to get through it. Highs and lows. We talked about it, right? You just force yourself to learn. But can you talk about like how one can figure out how to estimate rehab costs in a property? And then like, I have a couple other questions along the way on like how to boost value and things, but just.
I've got a couple being a baby boomer, you know, I didn't grow up with spreadsheets or computers or anything like that. That came along later. And I was I'm still a slow learner when it comes to that stuff. If you know me, this is I'm on my laptop right now, but this is my computer here. And I go through these things, you know, one a week. And then I scratch the beginning date on the front page. And I've got a cabinet over here that's full of them. And I sometimes have to go back and reference it. It's archaic, but you know, it kind of works. And then Allie and, you know, Yuko, my wife, kind of keep me straight.
For those listening, he's using a white or yellow notepad. And he has the names Ryan and Corey on it, waiting for the notes. So
yeah. And I've got, and I've got Beverly on top, and I don't even know who she is.
Love it.
Yeah. But that's so important to write everything down on a daily basis so that you can kind of follow what you were doing that day. Cause yeah, a lot of times we'll put it in here. Right. And that just tells you when you got to be somewhere. That doesn't tell you what you're thinking when you're doing it. Right. So I refer to that a lot. I refer to it so much, and I can go back to a certain day. It's like, I think that was Wednesday when I talked to that guy, but I didn't want to put him on my phone. Didn't seem that important at the time, but now I need him. And I go back and it's like, damn, I've got it there. That's great. So it's important. And I'll carry a small one in my pocket sometimes. But figuring things out. Good question. I have for looking at rentals to see if they're going to cash flow, I have a thing called the 40% rule. So that's not what you're asking, but I'm going to share that one real quick. So basically 40% of your rent, and this is just a general rule to see if the building's even worth looking at, right? If it doesn't fit this criteria, I don't look in. I don't give a darn,
I say
what anybody says about it, because if it doesn't work for you, I don't give a shit. But if it does, that's great. But 40% rule states that 40% of the rent is going to go towards expenses, which is your CapEx, your repairs, your vacancy, insurance, management, blah, 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 utilities, all the things that go along with it, plus debt service. All right. So debt service plus 40% of the rent is pretty much what your expenses are going to be every month. Guaranteed, after all the years I've done this, that's pretty much where it ends up. It might not look like that for 2 years. One, you know, when you're beginning, you might go, oh, Mark, my expense ratio is only 20%. It's like, just wait and see.
That's so funny.
Until someone puts a meth lab in one of your.
Ours is like 33%. So we're cool. We can play, or 28, maybe we can play with the next seven. That's fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is to go off what you're saying is we've only been doing it for, 2 to 3 years now. And we're having some of our properties have had major capital expenditures up at front. Some of them haven't. I'm literally at, this is hilarious. As we're on this call, I'm getting texts about a water leak, an active water leak in my property. I'm like,
here we go.
It's just, here it is. Like, so it's funny that you're talking about this, but I love the 40% rule. I think that sounds to me like it's conservative, but having known that you've done it over this extended period of time, it sounds like you should be someone that we should be listening to on it.
It really should be closer to 50% for apartments, because you've got all the fun and games of leaking into other units and people that are, you know, people come and go a lot quicker than they do on a single family house. There's a lot higher turnover rate. So you just have more expenses. So people look at that and they go, well, nothing's ever going to cash flow. And it's like, well, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. It will, but just don't buy stupid, you know, don't start stacking units. Because what happens too is people will do a rehab on a unit and they'll look at the next 5 or 6 years and go, oh man, this is gravy. And then stuff starts breaking again. And then they go, oh wait, this ain't gravy. I wasn't saving any money. So that $200 a month or $100 a month I'm making per door, you know, the last 3 years of that is gone now. It's just left, walked out the door. So as far as figuring construction costs and dealing with that, I know that was kind of the question. We obviously have a formula. I can literally walk through a house in 5 minutes and give you a price of what it's going to cost to fix it. But that's just based on so many years of doing the same thing over and over. It's like, you know, a car mechanic can hear a certain noise on your Ford and go, oh yeah, I know that's the catalytic converters, blah, 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 or the lifter, or it's whatever it is. I'm not much of a mechanic. And, you know, whereas you didn't have any idea, but I can do that with a house, just not because I'm smarter than everybody, just because I've done it more, right? Been doing it all my life. So I have a distinct advantage there, but really you need to learn from your first one. So I don't teach people how to flip houses. I have in the past, but none of my material covers flipping. That is coming up, but that's so much more extensive than wholesaling and buy and hold. But generally we have a list of repairs. We have a list that we go through that my wife and I compiled over the years, and we just plug in numbers. And in fact, she even made a spreadsheet on, you know, how to quote it. And I'll give you one of the cheat codes away. When we wholesale houses, we basically use $35 a square foot for repairs. So if it's a really light rehab, that's way too much. If it's a really heavy rehab, it's too little. But you know, when we wholesale, we expect whoever is going to be buying that house to have some knowledge.
Right.
You know, every once in a while they'll tell me, so are these the exact numbers? And it's like, nah, it's kind of up to you to figure that part out. But
cool.
Go ahead.
So for listeners too here, because we didn't get too nitty gritty in there. There's two books I'd recommend. The one is the book on estimating rehab costs by Jay Scott. That it shows you like the bone, basically gives you the ins and outs of the bones of a house, and you learn exactly what a house is made up of. And then it walks you through all the different types of renovations and things that an estimate on how much they could be upgraded for. That just, that'll give you like a bird's eye view into it, but then physically going through a property is where you're really going through the motions and experiencing it. Then you can kind of play around with it. Another book is the Burr Method by David Green.
Mm-hmm.
Teppers into it a little bit, but I also want to say one fun thing that I learned this weekend. It's kind of a random side thought. The Home Depot app is amazing. Like we went through and I'm like trying to estimate how much nails are going to cost, blinds, all this stuff. And you literally type in the store next to you, type in the blinds. It'll tell you, give you all your options. And then you click it, tells you the bay and the bin it's in. And I was like, honestly, it seems so simple, but I was mind blown. I'm like, I'm officially like an old man now. I was getting jacked running through the Home Depot aisles.
Yeah. No, that's so funny. And you know, you go Saturday morning and tuck your shirt.
Well, Mark, what's funny about this is that you kind of just told us without telling us that you kind of have to go screw some things up a little bit and just and make these mistakes and get stuff wrong.
That's
what's going to shape your.
Well, wow. That's true somewhat. So guys, keep in mind that when I started, there wasn't a lot of this kind of stuff around. I mean, there was guys that had done this before, but you know, it wasn't until like 2 years ago when I started bringing these young people into the office that I started opening up and sharing things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't even know where this was going when I started doing that, but it just felt good to do it finally, because I've been keeping everything to myself. I thought everything was a secret. And so everybody else felt that same way when I was doing it at the beginning. Most people didn't want to share what they were doing. They didn't want to like show how to get deals. They didn't want to show how to comp deals or the 40% rule or how to figure out a rehab. Why would they want to do that? What good does that serve? Now I've learned that it serves a lot of good, because now people want to come and work with us, right? They look at us and they go, oh my God, that seems like they really know what they're doing. I'd like to come and work with them or bring them deals or whatever the case may be. It's the benefits are tenfold. Such a beautiful thing. And then we can help them.
Totally. And you're giving back. Like, think about it. You probably reach a certain age and like you change the way you think and look at the world a little bit. I mean, we're young bucks ish, but to like, I don't know, more well off than some, and have had an easier upbringing than some people. And I just like, I like giving back, and I kind of feel like we owe it now because we've been through it. And it, you know, it gets us going a little bit too. Like people to your point here, like, family members, older people, and like not older, but like I would say like 50s, 60s, they never shared stuff. Like even like tips on financial literacy and like how to manage your money and things. Everything was like a secret. It's like, oh, you'll figure it out along the way. It's not really taught in school. So I think it is important for us to all talk about it now to help the other guy, because 70% of the world doesn't know what they're doing. Maybe more.
Well, probably nice more there. Than that. I'd say close to 99%.
But it makes you feel good, right? And like there's something about giving back and just sharing.
Totally. And you know, again, you know, when, let's be honest, when you're driving down the road or walking out of a 7-Eleven and someone holds a cup out and you drop a couple bucks in it, let's all be honest. We're doing it because it makes us feel good. We're not literally doing that because we want to help them buy beer or whatever it is they want. I mean, we just have to be brutally honest with ourselves and realize that we're doing it for us. And once you could fully embrace that and admit that, it becomes so much easier to help other people. Because, you know, being altruistic is an awesome thing, but there are so few individuals in the world that are really that way. My mom is that way. She is just absolutely always out there helping people, doesn't expect anything in return. But most of us don't do that. And until you can learn to embrace that and love yourself in spite of the fact that you're a greedy bastard, because I mean, we all have that thing inside of us that wants to survive, right? It's a survival skill. And whatever I can do to help me survive better is going to be better for me. And it's going to be better for people around me, because I can't give back if I'm not taking care of myself. You know, the oxygen mask thing, it's, you know, put your oxygen. I've been using this all the time. It's getting old, but you know, they always tell you on the airplane, put your oxygen mask on first and then help the others around you. It's not because you don't care about everybody else, but you can't help others unless you help yourself. Right. So I'm helping myself by donating money to this guy. It makes me feel better. It makes me want to help more people because I like that shot of, and it gives you a shot of dopamine whenever you help somebody. So this is the same thing. I feel so good teaching people to do stuff, you know, on Instagram and YouTube. Yeah. But at the same time, I know that it's going to help me too, because these people start going, Mark, you know, I've got this deal in such and such a city. I don't know what to do with it. I finally got one, but now I don't have any buyers. It's like, well, we just happen to have a list of buyers and we can take care of that for you. And so now it's a win-win for both of us. So
full circle cycle. It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And the earlier you learn that in this game, the better off you are. I mean, you gotta work with other people.
It's kind of like an ego check thing. That's a pretty deep rabbit hole we could go down, but it's
an important one.
It is important, but it goes to the fact of like I think we may have mentioned this before, but we talk about when you're a kid or like, I don't know, like seventh, eighth grade, right? Like you're roaming down the hallway and you know, everybody, you want to look cool. And like the next guy wants to look cool. It's like, but everyone is always thinking about themselves and not what the other person is and what the other person's thinking about you. Right. Like it's just an uncomfortable thing. And like, it travels with you a little bit until you realize like, it doesn't freaking matter, man. Like everyone is worried about themselves. You're afraid to stand up in front of a room. Half the people are thinking about how they can better themselves from what you're saying. They don't care what you look like. They don't care half the things you're saying.
Yeah.
That is such a great thing to say, because most people don't realize that, you know, the mistake that you make, you think everybody's watching. They're not watching you. They don't care about you. They just care about what's going on with them. And if they do see the mistake, all they're thinking is, thank God it wasn't me. Right. That's all they're thinking. But they're not getting the lesson from it, though. They're just watching it happen and going, oh, thank God it wasn't me. But you're actually learning from it, going, OK, it's like touching a hot stove. Right. Touch it once. It's like, damn, I know now that if I touch that hot stove again, it's going to hurt like hell. So I'm not going to do that anymore. And it's the same thing in investing. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to do deals with people that you shouldn't. You're going to buy things you shouldn't. You're going to spend more money than you should. You're going to do all kinds of silly stuff. So just be ready for it. And, you know, out of all the money we've made, you know, we've lost $1 million. I mean, I added it up. We've lost about $1 million in stuff that didn't work.
Wow. That's cool that you're willing to admit that. And the fact that you're willing to go through that, you said it's almost like a stock chart where you're going to have this ups and downs. And you look back at one day and you realize, well, we came from all the way down there, no matter how many ups and downs you had. So we want to talk about to stay on the contracting side a little bit. Like what are some tactics that you use or some specific implementation strategies that you use to force appreciate some of these homes or apartments as you do renovations? What are some high level things that help force appreciate homes?
Well, obviously kitchens and bathrooms, you know, the carpet and paint goes a long ways, but kitchen and bathrooms are good. A lot of people forget about what's behind the walls when you take on an apartment complex that has empty units. You know, open up the walls a little bit and see what's behind there, because once someone moves in, it's going to cost you money. If there's a problem, it's going to cost you money. We found that out with a 12 unit apartment complex. We had a lot of issues. We fixed a lot of stuff, but I didn't open up the walls. I didn't look underneath the tubs. You know, I didn't cut out behind the tubs. I had to move a kitchen cabinet to get to the back of the tub. And we ended up having to replace half the tubs, the plumbing, the drains underneath, because they hadn't been touched in so many years. And had we just done that before people moved in, it would have been so easy. But we did it after the fact. Forced appreciation comes from not having to spend, money later on, right? That doesn't really create appreciation, but it keeps you from having to spend the money later on. But forced appreciation is always bringing a building up to standards, not overdoing it, right? Like you can't build the Taj Mahal in a crappy neighborhood because you're not going to get more rent. You're going to cap out. So what I always do is I look at a neighborhood and I go, okay, these are the highest rents. This is the average rent. I look at the highest and the average. And that's what I base everything on. People think that there's so many important formulas and everything. I don't have formulas, guys. It's just simply just looking at a couple of numbers. I don't need the ROI and the IRR and all that crazy stuff and cap rates and things. Is it going to cash flow? It's a really simple question. Is it going to cash flow based on what I put into it? And it doesn't even matter what you put into it. If you're planning on holding it for the long haul, you know, your COC is, it's a fun number to brag about. It's like, oh, get 75% cash on cash. And it's like, dude, I get 1,000,000,000% cash on cash because I don't put shit into deals. I don't put money down on them. If they don't work with zero down, then I don't do them. So everybody does things differently, but I mean, these are just numbers that you can brag about. It doesn't matter. It's what you end up with at the end of the month that really, really matters. You set that standard. People are always asking me, Mark, you know, and I'm sorry, we'll go back to construction. People are always asking me, Mark, what's the best number I should get every month cash flow? It's like as much as you can get. And don't go for the minimal amounts because that's stupid. Don't be stupid. If you're going to come back to me and say I'm cash flowing $150 a month per unit, I'm going to say you're stupid. No offense, but you're stupid. And you're going to get bit in the ass and it's going to hurt really, really, really bad. And your job's going to end up paying for the repairs, not the rents. So, but getting back to the construction and forced appreciation, do the things that are going to get you the most rent. So it's really, really simple. In any town, you can look at what's for rent, what's getting $1,200 a month and what's getting $900 a month. Why is the $1,200 a month, $1,200 a month? Look at the pictures. It's never been easier to look and see what everybody else is doing. It used to be, you have to guess or have an inside person go look at these other units. Why are they getting so much money? I don't know. Let's go look. Well, we can't look. Henry knows us. He's going to know. Okay, well, let's go send Mary over there. He doesn't know Mary. Mary can go look and, you know, and see what's going on. And guys, the pictures are on the internet. I mean, what's behind the walls isn't going to get you more rent. It's just going to save you money. It's what they're putting into it. The kitchen, you know, they got shitty cabinets that they painted, but they put granite countertops in. That gives you a lot more money right there. Stupid granite counters, putting in a new tub enclosure, spraying a tub, putting in a toilet, putting in new faucet, putting in new light fixtures, scraping the ceilings, you know, putting in vinyl flooring instead of vinyl plank instead of carpet. You know, these are things that people are looking for. Look at what the trends are. Look at what people are paying more money for. And that is going to give you the most. What color scheme is pleasing to people? You know, when you drive by an apartment complex that's been a piece of shit for 30 years and someone paints it gray with yellow trim, it's like, wow, that thing pops.
Yep.
That's it. That's all they did. And they cut the lawn, you know. But now all of a sudden it's such a hip place. Now people are drawn to it. Now you've got the fish looking at the bait, right? Now you got to make sure they bite, which it means you got to do the stuff inside that makes the most sense. So you got to draw them from the outside to get them to the inside. And by doing the things that everybody else is doing, that's great. I think what scares me is when people, you know, start doing way more than they need to. It's like, I'm going to have the nicest units in town. It's like, that sounds good. Do you need to? Do you really need to have the nicest unit? I'm going to replace the kitchen cabinets. I don't really want to paint these. It's like, okay. Everybody else is painting them. Everybody else is painting them. You're going to put in $3,000 more in cabinets because why?
Can you talk about spraying the tub really quick? I know I hate our frigging tub at this new unit. And it's like, everything else looks so mint and perfect. And this thing's old. I don't want to get a new one. What do you just, is there like a spray that just makes it
look epoxy? Well, you can, Home Depot sells it. It's a two-part epoxy. You mix it up and you roll it on and then it levels out. Or you can have it. There's people in, what city are you guys in?
We're South Philadelphia, Jersey. South Jersey. Yeah.
Okay. So there's multiple people there that do epoxy tubs. They come in and they mask everything off and they prep it and paint it.
Great.
Not painted. They spray epoxy on it. And depending on the job, it'll last, it can last 10 years. It can last 3 years. Depends on how good of a job they do. But what it does is it just, you can pick your color. We always pick bright white because it just pops.
Yeah.
You can spray the tile, you can spray the tub, and you can spray sinks. You know, we just did a flip out in the desert and we sprayed the countertop, believe it or not, in one of the bathrooms, and we sprayed the kitchen sink, and it saved us, you know, because the one of those stupid things you look at, it's like, oh, let's just replace the countertop in the bathroom. Sounds good, but that countertop has a built-in sink and it's got a faucet that's functioning. And the mirror goes down to the top of the counter, and it's one of those sheet glass mirrors that's glued to the wall.
Yep.
So now we got to pull that off to get the counter out. Oh gosh. Okay. Now we got to replace that. That's $150 plus labor. Then we got to do this and that and the other and blah, 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 blah. And then at the end of the day, you spray the counter for $200 versus $1,000. So
can you talk, does that work for kitchen counters too? By any chance?
Yeah, we've done it. Yeah.
Is it an epoxy? Like, we need to do that as well.
It's an epoxy, but I don't know if I'd suggest doing that. I've done it on rentals before and it lasts for a while, okay. But kitchen counters, I tend to just replace with the least expensive granite they've got.
Got it.
Just because it's more impervious to stuff, you know.
I like your approach, which is just keeping it simple. Like, that's really what you're telling
me. Yeah, I mean, we're not trying to cheap out. We're trying to find a happy medium, right? You know, where we can provide them a nice clean place to live and we can make money. That's the bottom line. You know, one unit isn't going to make us rich, right? 1,000 units is going to make us rich, or 100 or whatever your goal is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a volume game. So you have to always look at it, because if you've got multiple units too, you've got to look at it. Everyone's a learning experience, because you can go back to the next one and go, oh, I saved money on that.
Mm-hmm. You got to go through it. So speaking of becoming rich, just to get people excited, I know it's a numbers game and you're climbing a bunch of units. Can you talk about your most lucrative deal then and why it was so exciting, and maybe just get someone that's semi-interested in real estate investing, like the shiny object syndrome? Like, what was the best deal you ever did?
Well, we've got one right now that's pretty exciting, but I'm not going to share that one yet because we're not done with it yet. But
bad juju.
I think, you know, we've had a few flips that were, you know, north of $200,000 profits, but we did have one wholesale deal that was a flip that is exciting, just because we bought it. We were going through the planning process with the city, and probably 2 weeks into it, after we closed escrow, we were already, you know, getting ready to submit plans and for a full second story add on. And it was in a place called Venice, California. Venice is where the guys, that's where,
yep, Venice Beach, baby.
Weights. Yeah. But this is, you know, inland a half a mile, and it's a bedroom community and it's really a hot area. And this was, God, like 4 years ago, four or five years ago. We bought this place for, I think, $600,000, and it probably, the way it sat, which right now it would probably sell for $1 million plus today, the way it sat, a little two bedroom, one bath, you know, 800 square foot house. And someone came along before we got too far. We just submitted, you know, like the footprint of the house to the city to see if the setbacks were good and everything. And we told them what we wanted to do, and we wanted to make sure it was okay. So we hadn't spent a lot of money. And someone came along and said they wanted to buy the house. And I said, sure, I'll sell it to you for $800,000. And jokingly, and they came back the next day and said, done. So we made $200,000 on that. And since then, you know, we get some wholesale deals that are $80,000, $30,000. Everybody's got a big story, but, you know, I think our average wholesale fee is $25,000 to $30,000.
That's pretty cool, Mark, because I got two texts yesterday about I guess they're from investors or the texting services that are like, we want to buy your one of my properties. Two, randomly, I think they were separate, but they might have been part of the same thing. And I, in my head, I'm thinking, all right, I'm just going to say here $100,000 over what it's worth and just see what they say. I actually didn't text them back, but that's essentially what you did. You were like, all right, let's see if they bite. And then they did, yeah. You know, and that might've been a home buyer, a person who's going to live there versus an investor, I'm sure. But like,
it was for sure, but it doesn't matter who it is in the end. You know, it doesn't matter if it's an iBuyer. It doesn't matter if it's Jim the Flipper. It doesn't matter who it is. You know, people see the value in a piece of property. I don't care how they come to their numbers. Doesn't matter to me. I'm not there to educate the buyer.
So on that 200K, how are you taxed on that? So you make
heavily,
that,
heavily, what? Heavily.
Okay.
Heavily.
Unless, but, can you roll it in? Can you do, it's not like a 1031, right? But can you roll that money into something else where you get taxed less?
No. Not flipping and wholesaling. Don't ever mistake that for anything other than a taxable job. It's heavily taxed. But the more units you own, the more tax deflection you've got, right? You've got the ability to deflect a lot of income by owning more rentals. So you're able to keep more of your day job money. I mean, flipping and wholesaling is a day job for us here. And buying and holding is, you know, that's the long-term play. There's a lot of other things we do too, but that's the gist of our business. The three cornerstones of investing. I think everybody should wholesale. I think everybody should flip a little bit. And I think everybody should buy and hold. And I think one should build off the other. You know, you do four flips, you keep one. You do 10 wholesale deals, you keep one. You just keep building that way. If you're, so many people limit themselves, they want to do this full time. Well, how the heck do you buy enough houses where you can replace your income? How do you do that? How do you know you're at that point? How do you know you're not going to have 17 water heaters go out in the same day? And then all of a sudden now your income is gone.
I wake up in the middle of the night sweating about having 17 water heaters go out in one day. So I
Yeah. I mean, but and AC units are even worse, right? I mean, that's $4,000 a pop right there, $7,000. So you can't count on your rental income for a long, long time. That's a fallacy. And I don't want people to think that buying 10 houses is going to get them retired. It's not. I mean, if you can live on a couple of grand a month, maybe so. But, and I know people, there's the haters that are going to say, I don't believe you, Mark. I got 10 houses. I make 7,000 a month and it's always consistent. And it's always been that way. It's like, yeah, okay, great. That's, you're an anomaly. You're not normal. Doesn't normally work that way, but that's great for you. But you can't argue with the truth. The truth and the facts are that you need a lot of real estate and you got to have money coming in. So I call it the three pillars, and it's, you got to do all three. I mean, you don't have to, but if you really want to make this a business, you can keep your day job and keep buying units and eventually you'll have enough. Or
cycles and they dump into each other.
Yeah. I love the way you brought that up. I don't know if you're connected with the Stealthy Rich on Instagram.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So I love the way they show their numbers and everything. And I was thinking about this. I think they have somewhere between, they just bought a big apartment complex, so it might be higher, yeah. But when we talked to them, it was like between 60 and 80 units. And I was looking at their chart of their cash flow, right? Mm-hmm. And they have months where they're, you know, this might be exaggerating, but I think it's like 30, maybe like $20,000 or $30,000, and you see 20, 30, 20. And then you have negative 10,
yeah,
negative
yeah.
14, yeah. up 15. And it averages out over the year. And I think they're cash flowing like $15,000 a month. Don't quote me. I don't know if that's the number, but the point is like, yeah, you could try to live on that, but if you can't support that negative $9,000 a month, it's going to be difficult. So you have to have income coming up, and that's 60 to 80 units, right?
And yeah, they're in Spring, Texas. So the markets, you know, you can get houses quite a bit cheaper there, and the rents are really high because Spring is just, it's a hot area, literally and figuratively. Here it's, you know, we on like a most excellent month, we'll cash flow 17. And on a not most excellent month, it'll drop down lower than that. But I think our average is probably between 12 and 15. And you think, oh, wow, that's not very much money, but it's not bad for not putting any money into it. So,
right.
Got it. Cool. Let's, as we start to wind down the show here, I have a couple random questions before we get into the last couple segments of our show. And
I'm an Aquarius. I'm an Aquarius, and I don't like alcoholic beer. So
okay, well that wasn't part of it, but I'm glad to know. So
shoot,
what is the story behind the Soft Wash Banana Republic T-shirt that you have on right now? I think
yes, I do. I can.
What is the story behind it? Because in all your stuff on Instagram, you get the white shirt on. So I want to know.
You know what? I wasn't trying to copy Steve Jobs in any way, shape, or form, but I like the simplicity of it. I've got like 10 pairs of jeans and like 40 t-shirts, and I just cycle through them, and it's just so easy. I don't have to think about it in the morning. It's just, I know what I'm going to put on. And on the weekends, I might put on a beige shirt or something like that. But
wow.
For the most part, I know I'm stepping out. I'm going crazy.
That's a weekend shirt for sure.
On the edge there, man. So I actually love that. I used to do this all the time. I used to just wear black t-shirts and whatever.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is. And I used to get so much shit for it. And I was like, look at Steve Jobs. And I gave him the quote, everything, and pumped it out. Like,
yeah.
And I just have been getting crushed, but I like this. We talked to, I forget her name. Shung is her name.
Yeah.
Save My Sense online. And, she's awesome. But she talked about having like a rotating, she has like five different, a shirt and like dresses, I guess, and like switches them in. She calls it like her capsule. And I love it. And you're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like you wake up, less decisions, and you just go on with your day. And
oh,
you feel
whoa.
Good. You're comfortable.
Totally. Totally. I mean, literally, I can be on the phone when I'm grabbing my clothes before I hit the shower. You know, I have a morning routine, you know, get up early, read, go to the gym, and then come home and eat, take a shower. I mean, I do all the normal stuff that people do, but there's a lot of the decision making is not, I can actually think about and do other things while I'm doing all that, because I don't have to think about what I'm doing. Right.
Love it.
So, and picking out just a simple outfit. I mean, guys, literally, you didn't just grab a t-shirt out of the drawer today. You looked at it and you went, okay, no, it's not that one today. It's this. Yeah, that's the one. And it stops that train of thought. So, I mean, I'm not the most productive guy in the world. I'm the most scatterbrained person you'll ever meet. But whatever I can do to make it simple. So, yeah, that's a good question. And I just like them. Yeah.
Love it. It's in your Instagram bio, so we know you like it.
Yeah.
In a good way.
That's Allie. Allie put that in there. So.
Oh, she. Okay, cool. Yeah. All right. So we are down to the second to last segment of the show. It's our core four. We ask this to each of our guests just so we can pick your brain, get to know you a bit, share with our listeners. Start off pretty easy and then get a little heavier. First one is, what is your favorite investing or real estate book? And why do you love it so much?
I've read a few investing books, not a lot. I'll be honest with you. I tend to spend more of my time with a yellow pad and a calculator than reading in the morning. Mm-hmm. What am I reading right now? I'm reading I'll think of it in a minute. I'll think of the name of it. But it's I'll read stuff that's not even related to real estate. But I mean, like everybody, the one book that really turned the switch on was Rich Dad Poor Dad, and only because it was a concept I hadn't thought of before. Now I don't subscribe to a lot of the stuff he says anymore, now that I've matured in the business. But I'm not a big business book reader. I mean, the Latte Factor, I think, The Millionaire Next Door, those were pretty good. Those were interesting books to me. So
great. The second question of our core four is, what's been the biggest mistake you've made in your investing journey, and how have you learned from it?
Biggest mistake was definitely teaming up with someone that didn't align with me. I lost a ton of money in Hawaii doing some development projects over there. And the guy that I was working with ended up just walking away from it. And I had all my investors' money in it. So I actually had to see those projects through, and you know, it took 3 years of my life to do that, and I didn't make any profit on that. I ended up just getting my investors' money back. So me and my wife's assistant is also named Yuko. We worked for 3 years to get that stuff finished up, get through the city, get permits. A lot of these projects had never had permits pulled, and they were almost built. And so we had to go back and restart the process, and it took years. But that was my biggest mistake, is putting my money or my client's money into somebody else's hands and trusting them and not being involved in the process. And that was, don't ever, ever do that. I mean, I have people that invest with me that have been doing it for years. But if you're going to be an investor when you're beginning, make sure you're involved. Make sure you know what's going on. Make sure that you verify who the person is. This guy had a really bad track record, but he had hidden it. But with a little bit more digging, I would have found out. But I didn't dig that deep because he mesmerized me.
Third question.
Third question of the core four. Who is your who for 2021? By meeting this person, you feel your life and your business will be propelled to the next level. If you haven't, who's someone in your business or in your life that has helped elevate your business to the next level and taken you to new heights?
The team of 25-year-old, 22-year-old, 21-year-olds that are in my office right now have absolutely upped my game up 1,000,000%. Just awesome. Being around people that are on fire. Yes.
Amazing.
Absolutely. Those guys, Allie and Max and Sauce.
Your whole team.
Yeah. Love it.
That's great. That's how you build a team. So fourth question, what do you want your legacy to be as you grow older, and what are you doing it all for, Mark?
I'm not one of those guys that's doing it for his kids. I'm doing it for the sense of security that comes from having assets. That's the bottom line. And if my kids get that in the end, that's great. If not, hopefully I've taught them well enough to do it on their own. But it's just a comfort level that comes from making more than you need. Much, much more than you need. Yeah, that's it.
Put. I like that. Well put. Cool. We've reached the last segment of the show. It's called The Last Drop. And with this, it's just a simple question. Knowing what you know now, what would you go back and tell younger Mark, say 18, 19-year-old Mark? What advice would you give him as he, you know, takes the next step in his life and career?
Easy. Don't get bogged down in trying to make money with your job. Make money with your job and invest the money. Get involved in, I don't care if it's not real estate, build a business that makes money. You know, so many people look at businesses that are involved in real estate and go, oh, that's a bad way to go. Well, guys, you got to have money to make money. You know, you just don't pull it out of thin air. So have a viable means of income and invest it. Start investing now. My kids all invest. And if I started when I was 18 or 19, I would probably have 4,000 or 5,000 units right now. I mean, think about it. Think about the fact I started when I was 46. That's insanity.
That is insanity.
That is. But you're gonna be a happy 65-year-old. So don't worry about that. That's awesome.
Oh, I'm happy.
And you're happy now, I'm sure.
I'm so happy. Yeah,
that's great. Well, Mark, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show. You dropped a lot of wisdom on us and for our listeners. So if people want to get in touch with you, how can they find you, whether it's on social or anything else?
Easiest way is we answer all of our DMs. So Mark McMahon Real Estate on Instagram, and also Mark McMahon Real Estate on YouTube. You can contact me either way, but obviously Instagram's easier. I or Allie are on there every day, constantly. We have a list of how to get started on getting your first purchase, your first piece of real estate. It's in my bio on Linktree on Instagram. And it's just a list on the steps you have to take, because most people can't get started because they don't have this, that, or the other. Kind of takes you through it. So it's a nice way to get started. And then also we've got our wholesaling course that's going to be coming out next month. And it will be announced on my Instagram. And we're really good at what we do. And we really, really do it every day. So, you know, I'm hoping people can appreciate that and shortcut, go through this process without losing as much money as I did.
We've seen it firsthand. You teach a lot and coach a lot on Instagram, and it's all free game. So we truly appreciate it.
Thank you
so much for the time tonight. And, for those listening, go follow Mark at Mark McMahon Real Estate on Instagram. You won't regret it. And, Mark, thank you so much. We really value your time.
Guys. I appreciate it. I enjoyed this.
Thank you, Mark.